The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
In most cases that we have, not all, but most, there's an offer or even a significant offer on the table. So you have the devil on one shoulder saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice to take the weekend off? You won't have to work. There won't be any pressure. And then you have the angel on the other side saying, that's not enough. You can do better for these folks.
Greg Barnhart reveals his test for knowing when to take a case to trial and how, surprisingly, he still pulls all-nighters.
I'm competitive, as all trial lawyers are, but I also procrastinate. So if you want to be successful as a competitive lawyer, but you do procrastinate, you have all-nighters that you have to pull. And I still, unfortunately, pull all-nighters.
And his view about balancing the profit motive and the client motive in trial practice.
The kind of people who are drawn into trial work have to have that appreciation for doing the right thing for the right reasons.
Welcome to Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Greg Barnhart refers to trials as the ultimate game. While certainly a competition between two sides, he insists that juries expect to be entertained. To be a successful trial lawyer, as you'll hear, you have to be entertaining and tell a story. He's won more than $90 million to date in verdicts and settlements for his clients, including, at one point, the largest personal injury verdict in Florida history. Along the way, he served as president of the Florida Justice Association, and he's won the Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award from the association. He's a law school professor and a former chair of the 4th District Court of Appeal Judicial Nominating Commission. Greg Barnhart sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in July 2018 to share his in-depth trial technique, the importance of having a healthy ego, and the story of the widow who refused to settle that inspired him to the biggest victory of his career.
Greg, among your notable cases, a $56 million verdict, an Amtrak derailment case that actually went all the way up to the Supreme Court. Just one of the cases in a very, very brilliant career.
Well, thank you. That, unfortunately, it went up to the Supreme Court. We try to keep things out of the appellate courts if we possibly can. So that case was a long one. It was a terrible tragedy. It was an Amtrak train, and Amtrak really did nothing wrong. They're using CSX tracks, and CSX had adopted a typical business model, which was cut costs. And so when they cut costs, they cut people, and the people who were the most expendable were the inspectors of the track to see if it was in good shape. So we didn't know anything about railroads and railroad track, but you learn. And it's, believe me, it's not the highest technology in the world. It's 18th century, 19th century technology, and it really hasn't changed. So what happened was there was a section of track in South Carolina, and the people who are responsible for sections of track are called roadmasters. And so what happened was, because the roadmaster and his inspectors couldn't do their job, they just made it up. And so they would file inspection reports where they hadn't inspected anything, or they'd go along at 20 miles an hour on these inspection vehicles and say, oh, it looks good to me. So what happened was a train from Washington, D.C. to Miami, containing mostly Floridians, derailed in South Carolina. And at the time, 8 people were killed and about 80 some were injured. And one of the people who was killed was Sergeant Paul Palank. And his wife, she didn't accept offers from the other side, and everybody else settled their cases, everybody else. And she came to us and to other lawyers and said, I want somebody who's going to try the case. I want to try this case. And we said, well, you're in the right place. We'll do that. I've heard that before many times. And sometimes the clients change their mind, and many times they don't. And believe me, she did not want to change her mind. So we went ahead and discovered the case and ultimately started the case. And it was down in front of a now dead judge, Judge Arthur Fanza, who was a wonderful judge, but he kept banker's hours. And the case went started, we did, the original judge trifurcated the case. And in a punitive damage case, you're supposed to bifurcate it between, are they at fault? What are the damages, the compensatory damages? And then whether or not there's punitive damages which may or may not be awarded. And that's a yes or no. And if it's a yes, then the next day you go on to maybe a 2-day trial of how much. So this judge, the previous judge, decided to trifurcate the case. So we had to try a 3-week trial on compensatory damages. And so then, and we got a verdict there. And then we started whether or not Paul Palank would be entitled to punitive damages, yes or no. And 6 months later, the verdict came back as yes. 2 days after that, the verdict came back at $56 million. So there were many appeals that went on, and the 4th District Court of Appeal was tried in Fort Lauderdale, so that's where it went, said, affirmed the case. The Florida Supreme Court affirmed the case, and we thought it was over. And so we got, money was wired to us. They weren't going to pay. And then we said, well, we're going to execute on your locomotives if you don't pay. And so the money showed up in our bank. So we were about to distribute it, and then we get a notice of a writ of certiorari to the United States Supreme Court, which for a plaintiff's lawyer on the winning end is not good news. It was terrible news. Our client was not happy with it. And then for the next, I don't know, 6 months or so, we had to wait in the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, I've never seen a decision, and I've never actually seen one. And this one simply said, cert denied. So we finally got it. And it turned out it made a huge difference. It was, you know, our client was dedicated to this and safety, and it turns out they had a switch that was installed backwards. It took a while to figure that out, but it did, I hope it changed safety. There was a book by David K. Johnson, and it included a whole chapter on just this case. So it wasn't so much the tragedy, although that was there. It was what went on and was discovered, and how corporate America and the search of the almighty dollar cuts back and kills people and injures people. Interesting story during that case. So the our client's name was Angel. That was her first name. Her husband's name was Paul. And so during the crash, right after the crash, there was a medical student in the same car. And he came over to Paul, and there were seats on him, and he had been crushed, but he could speak. And so the medical student, who was in his residency for OB-GYN, but they're still, you know, they're doctors, and he's trying to minister to him, and he realizes there's not much he could do. And Paul keeps saying, Angel, Angel. And so the doctor thought he was seeing angels. And then he died right there, and the doctor came back and testified in the court. And it's frankly one of the most powerful witnesses I've ever seen. Changed his life. Mm-hmm.
You regularly take on big tobacco, big pharmaceuticals, more than $90 million in verdicts to date. What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
Well, it's an interesting story to me anyway. So I come from a family of teachers and professors. My dad was a stockbroker. But if you were genuinely ill, then my mother would let us watch TV. If you know, you wouldn't go to school, you could watch TV. If you were malingering, or she thought you were, you had to go back into your room. So I was, I actually was ill. And if you were ill, I wanted to watch things like The Three Stooges or The Beverly Hillbillies. And she said, no, we're going to watch To Kill a Mockingbird with Gregory Peck. Gregory Peck, even I knew who Gregory Peck was when I was 11. And I said, well, I don't want to watch that. I like mockingbirds. I don't want to kill mockingbirds. And she said, no, this is a wonderful movie. So we watched it together. And sure enough, she was right. It was a terrific movie. So it wasn't as if the light went on and I said, oh, yes, that's what I want to do. But I did think that. I thought, boy, that's the right thing to do. What a good man. He did the right thing for the right reasons. And everybody in town was against him. And it hurt his kids. And it hurt his law practice. And then I read the book a little bit later, a few years later, when I got into junior high. And I felt the same way. And it never really left.
Sure.
And so I sort of orchestrated my life towards doing that. So I took all the speech courses. I always liked to talk, and I guess I was a natural ham. And then because I wanted to do that, I was in plays. I was in plays in high school. And then when I got to college, you can take different courses, and I took the rhetoric courses or the speech courses, and I also was in some plays in college. Not because I was any great thespian, I wasn't, but simply to feel comfortable on my feet. When I was in college and other people were saying, gosh, I wonder what I ought to do. I knew I wanted to be a lawyer. And to me, a lawyer was a lawyer who went to court.
What were the most important influences in your life growing up?
Well, it's important. I guess your parents. I mean, I know that some of my good friends who are trial lawyers have had difficult backgrounds. Mom and dad were divorced. Mom is usually the hero, dad often the heel. No, it wasn't for me. My parents were happily married. I had a nice group of friends and so on. But in life, probably it was a combination of my mother, who was the kind of person who... She came from privilege, and then her dad owned car dealerships and tractor dealerships, but he drank. And he went from a position of privilege to a position where he committed suicide, probably because he lost everything. It never changed her a bit. She didn't, you wouldn't have known it one way or another. And so when there would be social occasions, she would be the kind of person that would always talk to everybody and not just the people who were looking around the room to be there. And so, look, it wasn't as if she said, look, Greg, this is what you need to do. It was what you could see and the way to handle it. And handling people and relating to people and being kind to people is pretty much what I learned from her. And from my dad. My dad had Crohn's disease after, you know, he was a stockbroker. He had Crohn's disease. Crohn's disease eats up your intestines, just eats them up. And it's painful. You become malnourished, you're skinny. And, you know, he didn't put on the dog and trying to be an ex-athlete like, frankly, a number of the fathers of my friends. So what he did is they needed a coach, and he became the Little League baseball coach, and he really wasn't a baseball player. So he read the book on how to coach Little League, and his theory was that every boy played. And every boy couldn't start because we had too many people, but every boy played.
Sure.
From the very best to the very worst. And it would drive me up a tree because we were, I always had good eyesight and I could hit the ball, and it would be a really tight game. And you know, out I would come, out with some of the other starters, and more the young boys would come in.
Sure.
And ironically, we never won the championship. but we never came in less than second. And every little boy came, and then when he died, guys who were, you know, on our team, it was amazing how many people came to his funeral. And it was, you know, that's sort of what formed me, and I think that that has helped over my life. But I didn't have a tragic life. I had a good life. Still have a good life.
Besides the thespian skills, which would have helped your performance before a jury, before a judge, when you became a lawyer, you graduated Vassar undergraduate Cornell Law School. How did you go about honing your trial skills?
Well, first, in law school, you can take as many courses as you want geared that way. So I took trial techniques. There was a professor named Irving Younger who was a legendary speaker. I was just lucky that he was there. But the next thing you need is a job. And I got a job down here in my first year. It was not at our firm. It was at another firm. And I had clients. They were small cases. And I convinced my clients. I thought I was right. I really did think I was right to try their cases, even if it was in county court, which is small claims, really. And at the end of the year, I had tried 11 cases, you know, and I would get hot and bothered about things like a breach of a contract and so on. And I just can't tell you how many mistakes I made and how many mistakes of judgment and how many mistakes of being too aggressive. But I slowly got better. And then I was offered a job over here at this firm and thought about it for over a weekend. I was in a trial, and Bob Montgomery came up and said, how much are you making? And I said, well, Mr. Montgomery, I told him what it was, and he said, well, I'll double it if you come on over.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, it wasn't a lot, I can tell you that. So,
but to have someone of his stature.
Yeah, oh gosh, yeah. And he actually came up and said, I'm Bob Montgomery. I said, well, I know who you are, Mr. Montgomery. And anyway, after that, it was much easier because there were people here who were really good trial lawyers, legendary trial lawyers, quite skilled and with a different plate of skills and talents. And that sort of actually is what, you know, I teach younger lawyers to do, and that is you can't be somebody you're not. You can only be you, and you can be the best you, but you can't be somebody you're not.
You've also referred to trials as the ultimate game. Explain that.
Well, so a trial for the client is it. I mean, that's the culmination of whatever the case they're bringing is. But for a lawyer, I mean, think about it. So it's clearly a contest. Somebody's going to win. Somebody's going to lose. And when you start, when the judge says, is the plaintiff ready? Is the defendant ready? Well, there's only one answer. You can't say no. And that's done for staging. When you start out evenly. And what you do, you may not have an even Steven case, but what you do moves it along. And you know, you're doing your best for your client. You've got to be prepared. But if you don't have tactics, you're an idiot. And the tactics and the skills you employ are very much akin to being in a game. And then, so you have a jury. At least in our cases, we have juries. So what does the jury want? Well, they want to do the right thing, but they want to be entertained. They've watched trials on TV and in movies, and they expect and hope for some entertainment. So you have blended a contest with a play, and there are different acts. And you know, if you don't live up to those acts, the jury holds it against you. But that's why I think it is sort of the ultimate game, really.
Well, and at one point in one of those games, you won the largest personal injury verdict ever in Florida history in a local case right here, a medical malpractice case.
That was a long time ago, but yes, we did. We got the first eight-figure case, and it was a case involving damage to an 18-month-old girl, brain damage, severe brain damage. And we sued the local, two local pediatricians, one who had been the pediatrician to everybody in old West Palm Beach, everybody in Palm Beach, and was a lion in the medical establishment. And then we sued his partners. That case was interesting because very daunting for us, because they had offered at the time the unheard of amount of $4 million. And then they said they're going to withdraw it at high noon on Friday. Trial start on Monday. And I didn't think they would do it, but they did. And our partners were not particularly happy about that. I mean, they were, you know, they want you to win, so they don't want to lead you into dispiritedness. But so we start with nothing on the table after having turned down a large amount of money, but I just didn't think it was enough. And so we tried the case, and it was in the ceremonial courtroom. And once we started, it turned out that there was a memo, where we found out later, that the doctors and the technicians and the nurses were asked to show up in court in their whites, some even with stethoscopes around their neck. And so the—
Talking about drama and staging.
Yes, yeah, it's clearly staging. I don't know how dramatic it was, but it was overstaging, actually. So what happened is, if you were to walk into that courtroom, like any other ceremonial courtroom, there are two doors, and you would walk in, and you would see the judge up there, up high on his bench. You'd see the jury, in this case, over to the right. You'd see the two groups of lawyers and their clients. And then you would see on the left-hand side, the doctor's side, 80 or 100 people in white or shades of white who clearly looked medical.
Wow.
And then you'd see on the other side, my mother, who came for one day and decided to stay, another mother, and I wasn't married at that time, and then my partner's wife. And then other lawyers who would come in, you know, some from our firm, but just lawyers walking around the courthouse as they would, and they heard it was a big case, and
sure,
it was
sure.
Front page news about every two or three days for 4 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, and then at the end, at the end of the trial, the judge allowed them to call the defense, to call a surprise witness. And this was a judge who was a straight shooter, but it was his kid's pediatrician. And then it was through that lady that we found out that there was a note, a memo, to go ahead and have people show up. But we ended up getting a, you know, an eight-figure verdict at the time. And I was 31 years old. So
wow.
Yeah, and I looked about 15.
Right.
So that came out, and it completely changed my career, not because I was better, I think I learned, but simply it looked like I could actually handle a big case at that point.
Greg, what would you say is your key to success? Is there any one skill?
Well, to the extent that I've been successful, I think luck plays a big role. I think that being born into a nice family plays a role. Getting to go to college and law school played a role. Getting the jobs I got played a big role. Getting the clients I got played a big role. And a lot of that's just plain luck. Preparation is a key, and preparation, because I have to fight, I'm competitive, as all trial lawyers are, but I also procrastinate. So if you want to be successful as a competitive lawyer, but you do procrastinate, you have all-nighters that you have to pull. And I still, unfortunately, pull all-nighters. So you have to be willing to do that. The other part is you have to be willing to do it, because in most cases that we have, not all, but most, there's an offer or even a significant offer on the table. So you have the devil on one shoulder saying, oh, wouldn't it be nice to take the weekend off? you won't have to work, there won't be any pressure. And then you have the angel on the other side saying, that's not enough, you can do better for these folks. So if you try to work those, I think to be successful, in addition to having worked hard, prepared hard, and being lucky, you have to say, now is the time to go, and not back down.
Do we end up settling too many cases?
Oh, today? Yeah. I think that's clearly true. We don't try enough. That is, and you know, that's borne out. So people in our firm, including myself, are active in the bar, as we need to be. And the board certification qualifications, it used to require 25 trials. Now it's 15, and they've changed the criteria for those trials. And the number of civil jury trials are going down dramatically. Part of that's because we're not trying enough. And the other part, frankly, is because of arbitration and contracts and things. And that's a big change, particularly with the last two or three people on the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, you had the instinct in that case, though, to not take $4 million, and you ended up with so much more. But some criticize that the law has become too much of a business, the profit motive, versus to the kill a mockingbird, a force for societal benefit and change, client motive. Do you subscribe to that?
Well, I think it's more nuanced than that, Harvey. So look, in every case, if you ask a lawyer, yes, I'm seeking justice. I'm trying to do the right thing for my client. But there's a time in certain cases, not every case, certainly not every case, when you see justice being done. You see it. You feel it, you understand it. And when that happens, it's a magical thing. So to say that people are pushing the law one way or another, yes, there's always been a business component to the law, always. And if you don't mind the business component, you'll go out of business. You can't take care of your family, you can't take care of your staff, your firm won't do well, you won't have the money to finance cases on behalf of future clients. So that has to be done. On the other hand, the kind of people who are drawn into trial work have to have that appreciation for doing the right thing for the right reasons. Not always, and certainly not in every case, but in the right case. And when that happens, when you actually see justice being made, when you see a wrong being righted, then you understand why our system is so good and why the Anglo-American system has gone on with jury trials for hundreds of years.
Let's talk about development and personal practice for a lawyer. How helpful or hurtful can self-reflection be?
Well, if you don't self-reflect, you go headstrong without thinking. I mean, as a lawyer, you need to think about what you do right and wrong. As a human being, you're a fool if you don't think about where you are. This is, you know, let's face it, it's a job, it's your profession, but your family and your life are first. And if you don't mind both of those, then you can't be a very successful lawyer.
Tell us about the role ego plays in being a good lawyer.
Well, you know, ego has good and bad connotations. If you go back to the Freudian sense, I mean, that's who we are. But the way we use that term now, ego is who you are. Do you have the confidence to do it? That's a component. Do you have the skill to do it? Do you have the right case to go forward? Do you have the right experts? Do you have the right jury to turn down big offers during a trial? And there has to come a time when you, or in our firm, we try cases in teams, usually with at least one other lawyer. But there has to come a time when you say, I'm going all the way on behalf of my clients, or really, we're going all the way on behalf of our clients. And the client's always saying, Mr. Barnhart, what should I do? And look, if I knew what they should do, I would be an oracle. But what I think they should do is depends on, you know, the evaluation of things and then the ability to say, look, Greg, am I doing the right thing? Do I think I'm going to win this case? Can I win this case? And more often than not, the answer is yes. But you also have to have the ego to say, no, I think we're not doing too well in this case. I think it's time to do the best for the client and try and settle the case.
How do you handle disappointment?
Well, instead of drinking champagne, I drink beer. If you lose a case, and I usually feel like kicking my rear end, and then I go out and I work out, and I'm a swimmer. I've always been a swimmer, and I go swim laps until I basically can't pull anymore.
You are a past president of the Florida Justice Association. You 2017 winner of the Al J. Cohn Lifetime Achievement Award. A very small group of folks. How has your involvement with the Florida Justice Association impacted your career?
For the best. I started when I became a lawyer. I signed up, I joined, got a plaque, and then I got more involved in it pretty early on. It was a way to meet people. There's the social aspect, but they kept asking people to go to Tallahassee to lobby, and I went as a young lawyer and said, holy moly, look at the bullets that are going around our head. And then you realize how fragile the ability to practice the law we practice actually is, and how, you know, the barricades are not well manned. It's only back then the Academy of Florida Trial Lawyers, now the Florida Justice Association, they're talented, and they need all the help they can get. And then as I saw how dedicated people were and how good they were, how they had nice seminars, and they had ski seminars in Colorado, it was something that was just naturally attractive to me. And then honestly, trial lawyers are fun to be around. They really are. They're good storytellers. They tend to be big personalities, and I liked being around them. It was like, sure. I played sports all my life. It was like being in the, you know, being with the guys in the locker room, it's a lot of fun. And
yeah, you're with the MVPs.
Yeah, they really, well, you know, young lawyers too. It was everybody. And then I saw, as I moved up, I decided, look, I'd like to be president. And so I ran and won and so on.
Now, you ended up marrying one of your fellow Cornell law students. But how do you balance your professional life with your family life?
Well, you have to. My wife, Susie, she was a lawyer. She had a better job than I did out of law school. She worked at one of the biggest firms in the country. So she knows, she gets it, she knows. And so she has never, ever fussed about time away or time in a trial or, in fact, it's the other way. Are you ready? are you sure you're ready? Do you need it? Because she knows. But I have three little girls and not so little anymore. But yeah. What I do all the time is I always did homework, right? So I was used to it. I would go to their games. I've got my youngest is in law school right now, and I said, well, I'm going to do this podcast tomorrow, and I said, you know, I'm sorry I wasn't there that much. And she said, Dad, you're always at our games and plays and so on. And so unless I was actually in a trial, I did go, or at least I tried to go. And then I worked at night. Mm-hmm. But family comes first. And if you don't have a good, solid family, I think it would be very difficult to be a trial lawyer.
What about regrets?
You know, I've been very lucky in my career, and I don't regret it. I mean, do I regret not buying Amazon when it was low? Yeah, but that's kind of cheap stuff. It's almost tawdry. No, I don't regret the kind of law I did. If I had to do it over, I would do it again.
That's always good to be able to say that.
I think so.
Let's talk about the bigger picture. What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Do you have concerns?
Well, the legal profession is going to do just fine. Our branch of the legal profession, I do have concerns about. Big law is now bigger than ever. There are 1,000, 2,000 person law firms. And so we mentioned this earlier, but arbitration agreements are cutting into the ability to get to trial. Legislation is cutting into the ability to get to trial. Bigger cases and clients who won't let younger lawyers go interfere with it.
Meaning won't let them be first string.
That's right. And
your partner, Chris Searcy, talked about that.
He's right about that. It's so Chris and I used to try a lot of cases together, and we now have younger lawyers with us, and we always try to bring, not to every one of our trials, but we always try to bring the youngest lawyers just so they can get there, so they can be, even if they don't take a witness, just be there, see it. But then they start taking depositions. They go to hearings. And then they go to trials and they take a witness or two or three or whatever. There's only one way to learn to be a trial lawyer. You know, you can watch, you can read, you can be taught. But until you get up there on your feet, it's not the same. It's just not the same.
Greg, educating those young lawyers is important to you, isn't it?
It is. I've been giving lectures for the Academy and the Florida Bar for years. And now I started teaching at law schools, and the only thing I have to teach is really trial techniques. So what I started doing years ago was keeping a trial notebook, and I found it fascinating what lawyers would say in closing argument, because that's really, 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 really where the rubber meets the road. And people get so wound up, and they say the doggondest things. And so when I started, I wanted to know what could I say and not say, because there are certain things that if you say, if you just utter them, your case is going to be reversed. So I started keeping records of that. And now I have an outline, which I give every year to the Florida Bar and others, that's got to be up around 70 pages. And it's about closing argument.
Wow.
And one of the things I talk about is, in addition to what you can say and what can't you say, is that if you don't tell a story, you can't educate and you can't persuade. So we're hardwired, Harvey, to hear stories. Way before human beings could read, back in the caves or in the savannas around the campfire, what would people do? They would tell stories. And the best stories and the best storytellers were those people who were called upon again and again. And every story, we know this from literature, has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And if you don't present to a jury a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, then you'll lose the jury. And you won't educate. And you won't convince. And you won't persuade. And so getting people to that point and away from just structure, just how do I say this? What words can I not say? In the cases that, frankly, are reversed, the lawyer didn't need to say what he said or what she said. You could tell the story in most cases, probably all cases, better or in the same way with the same effect using words that didn't either insult people or deviate from what judges think is acceptable conduct.
What one piece of advice would you have for incoming lawyers?
I think the biggest secret, really the biggest thing for a young lawyer to do is first if you're not sincere about a case, don't take it. So sincerity is the key to success. Get in court enough to figure out what works and doesn't work for you. And when it does, practice it.
Greg, how would you like to be remembered?
Fondly. well, I'll tell you. So nobody gets out alive. It doesn't matter how many cases you've won, really. We've made plenty of money, and much more so than I ever thought or cared about, frankly. But I want to be remembered as somebody who did the right thing, who did not back down, who was honest, who was principled, who was intelligent, and somebody who made a difference. And am I going to make a difference in the lives of the Russians or the English? No. But in my family's lives, the lives of our people who work at our firm, certainly our clients' lives. That's how I'd like to be remembered.
Greg Barnhart, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.